I want to talk about populist movements. We know that they're taking hold in a number of Western countries in the past few years, France, the UK, and now most notably in the United States. And a lot of this is playing off identity politics, a sense of alienation among voters, and immigration. Let me start with you, David. What makes Canada different, or is it?
Well, first of all, Chris, I'm not sure that identity politics are at the core of what's driving the populist movements around the world. I think what's at the core of that is 30 to 40 years of an economy that's not been working for average people. And over that period of time, I think that people have come to have some serious doubts about whether the system is working for them and are looking for people who are change agents to that system. Now, in every jurisdiction, different elements get larded on. That can be anti-immigration sentiment, that can be racist sentiment, that can be misogyny, all sorts of things can get added on to that. But I think at the core of it, common across all jurisdictions, is economic anxiety.
So Canada wouldn't be any different then, because there's economic anxiety here?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think one thing, though, that does make Canada a little bit different is we're less divided on class lines than other places. The immigration, racial diversity, things like that are really points of national pride here in a way that that's not necessarily the case in the U.S. or the U.K. I mean, we had Kelly Leach try this kind of business. It didn't work very well for her. To a lesser extent, Kevin O'Leary tried it. I think there's some reasons for that, Chris. I think universal health care and equalization payments are two fundamental parts of the structure of the Canadian system that decrease the kind of class system that you need for that kind of populism, a critical ingredient in it.
I think it's really important, though, to back up a little bit. And populism often is thrown around in politics as a bit of a catch-all phrase. And at times it's almost foolishly broad, because there's a different kind of populism that my party, the NDP, or the CCF, its predecessor, had, which was at its root kind of arguing for people and farmers and people of different religious backgrounds, compared to the kind of populism that we might see and the rhetoric of divisiveness that we might see somebody like Doug Ford articulate. I think the challenge, when you look at it on a left-right spectrum, similar to kind of what David said, it does come down to an economic argument, but the parties of the left need to actually articulate solutions, not just further people's alienation.
You know, but I think Kathleen's point is correct, in that parties on the left have to frame these solutions in terms of benefit to individual families and to individuals, as opposed to benefits for society as a whole. I think the populism on the left has often been appealing to sort of the better angels, to a better place, a brighter whatever. And I think today, given the challenges that people are facing, how life isn't better than it was, need to rethink that and make it much, much more personal.
I 100% agree with all that. And I think, building on what Kathleen said, it's important to note that these movements are not conservative. They may be taken advantage of by Republican candidates or by conservative candidates, but they're not conservative in the sense that Donald Trump was elected on a massive intervention platform, a huge government platform. People expected him to tear down trade deals, single-handedly repatriate entire industries back to the United States, to build a wall to protect their jobs from immigrants, and to massively invest in infrastructure. People voted for not a conservative platform. Andrew Coyne would be appalled at that. That's a big government interventionist platform.
I wonder if in the Canadian context, if you look back in history, we had social credit, we had reform, we had the United Farmers. They were more regionally based. Would you guys agree with that? That it wasn't about the kinds of issues around immigration, but about a sense of alienation?
It's always about a sense of alienation,
yeah,
but historically it's been regional in Canada, not economic.
And I think politicians, right-wing politicians who prey on that kind of economic alienation, really try to even push aside the answers to firm questions, like we're seeing Doug Ford do right now. When he's asked straight up, well, what will you cut? How will you do this? He dismisses all of that and goes back to their alienation, because he can pivot off of that, back to the rhetoric and the catchphrases he's used time and time again to increase that alienation among people.
Yeah.
The job of progressives, on the other hand, is to do something brave. It's really to cut through those rhetorics and develop policies that actually create economic justice. That's the bravery of someone like Tommy Douglas, who can fundamentally change healthcare across Canada. But it's coming up with the solutions to that economic alienation and not just let the rhetoric and divisiveness continue.
Yeah, I think alienation is a $10 word for when people think things are just upside down. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what ends up happening is the pendulum swings back and forth, whether it's to the right or to the left, or whether it's even not on a right-left axis. When people just think things are wrong, that the priorities are in the wrong place, that they're left out, that they're left behind, that no one hears their voice, that things are upside down. And that's when they want someone to speak to it. And that's why people who, as much as he may frustrate Kathleen, that's why people who speak the way Doug Ford speaks are very successful at times like that, because they speak with clarity, perhaps with inappropriate clarity, or perhaps with not enough deftness or nuance. But that's not what people are looking at. They're actually looking for a bull in a china shop, and they don't mind if some china gets broken.
Because the shop isn't working for
them. Correct.
The system isn't working.
Correct.
So if you say, hold it, this person is so out of the mainstream, they're not going to understand how this system works at all. People go, perfect.
Let me broaden this a bit. All have mentioned Doug Ford. He's tapping into some populist sentiment here. But we also have François Legault in Quebec talking about, well, he'll limit immigration. He'll make sure there's an undefined Quebec values test administered. Is he on to the same thing?
Well, I don't know that they're playing it the same way. I don't notice any particular racial angle to Mr. Ford's appeal or to his pitch to people. And that is always where the sweet spot of Quebec politics is. If you can be seen to be somebody who's committed to the French project in that province and to building up the French community within Quebec, as long as you don't go to embarrassing lengths like the PQ did a few years ago with their legislation, that tends to be pretty galvanizing in the Quebec population.
Yeah, I think the conditions in Quebec are of course, markedly different than the rest of the country. Remember, they're also promising to cut immigration by 10,000 people a year, and that's a very, very direct appeal, you know, to a particular part of the electorate. Layer on that the values test, which doesn't work elsewhere, language issues and so on. I think you've got a completely different ballgame there.
I wonder what, Kathleen, just the last point on this. If you have a François Legault poised potentially to take power in Quebec, you have Doug Ford poised potentially to take power in Ontario, how does that change the dynamic as the federal government and the federal parties begin to look for their own election campaigns next year?
Yeah, I think it presents some challenges. I think Justin Trudeau's Liberal government has had a bit of peace so far on the federal-provincial-territorial relationship. They've had friendly governments in Alberta, BC, Ontario, Quebec up until now, and most of the Atlantic provinces as well. And that could change dramatically, not only with the change in governments you've cited, but potentially also in 2019 with potentially a change in Alberta. And so that will present problems in how they address these issues. But I think always when you focus on identity politics or the culture wars, you risk kind of not actually addressing why people may feel alienated at the root, which comes back to an economic justice argument. And while I think Jamie is absolutely correct that we have to create that empathy and that sympathy and understand where that alienation is coming from and connect to voters, you have to have the solutions. You have to put the policies in the window and you have to create a hopeful future.
I wanted to ask you all about the parliamentary tactics that we've been seeing. The Conservatives forcing a marathon voting session last week over the demands to have the Prime Minister's National Security Advisor testify at a committee. This is all related to the briefing he gave to the media during the India trip by the Prime Minister, where Jaspal Atwal, a guy who'd been convicted of trying to kill an Indian cabinet minister decades ago, was suddenly at events and being invited to events. Was it the MP who invited him? Was it fault? Was it an Indian Secret Service intelligence conspiracy? What is the strategy here for the Conservatives to continue to try to push the Daniel Jean come to committee to testify to tell us what he told the media?
Well, I'm not sure what the strategy is, but I certainly don't think this tactic this week was a very smart one. I mean, certainly on the day that they were keeping everybody up all night, the bigger news was the Senate passing the marijuana legislation. You know, like, we've got Stormy Daniels to the south, we've got Doug Ford, we've got secret meetings with the Chinese and North Korea. And I just don't think depriving some MPs of their sleep was a particularly smart maneuver. And it's just, these kind of tactics don't sit well with Canadians. I mean, how many times have we all heard, if I behaved like that at the office, you know, I'd lose my job. And I just think that the opposition has got to find a way to get off these kinds of tactics and get onto it, dealing with it in a more substantive way.
And yet
way.
The issue isn't going away, David. The polls, at least snapshots in time, suggest that the India trip is coming back to haunt the Liberals and the Prime Minister in terms of his own sort of standing with voters.
Yeah, I think that it's evident that the India trip is the weakest public outing that the Trudeau government has had, and it's a point of vulnerability for them. I think when you ask about strategy, though, the question is, these kinds of tactics that the Conservatives are employing now, the question is, do they build anything? At the end of the term, are people going to conclude that Trudeau is a lousy representative of Canada internationally or is embarrassing internationally? That's a big bet to make, because normally he's been pretty solid and pretty sturdy out there and effective on the international scene. Plus, that's not really the basis on which people generally vote in election campaigns. I think that generally an opposition party should be looking for where can we attack the government that builds over time a story about this government that will defeat them. And I frankly would have thought that the most recent budget offered more of an opportunity to do that, for not addressing any of the issues we were just talking about at the beginning of this program, than spending all this time trying to diminish Trudeau as an international representative of the country.
Well, I'm going to present a bit of a different view than my colleagues. Both Jamie and David have kind of looked outwardly at how the Conservative tactics have been played out. But I would ask listeners to think inwardly what impact that's happening on the opposition caucus. And I actually think what Scheer did last week was tactically important internally. I think, you know, he was elected without a lot of momentum, very squeaker kind of win as leader. He needed to build that solidarity in caucus. These kind of tactics where you build solidarity of spending 20 hours in the lobby fighting what they considered was a good fight does rally the troops. It does build your staff and your MPs behind you. It creates that solidarity. It rallies them. And it shows the focus that they're going to have on the election, which is still going to be ethics. And I think for that reason alone, it's helpful. And it also has been seen to have some effect in the polls in terms of that losing that male voter, which just seems to be a narrative that is coming out in the last few days.
All right, so one last question for you all. We've seen the testimony of Christopher Wylie. We've talked about this in other parts of the program. I'm interested from all of you, just a very quick line, about to what extent does this put pressure on political parties, for example, to be open to reviews by privacy commissioners to see how they manage Canadians' personal information? Let me start with you, David.
I think that would be perfectly reasonable and appropriate. I think that the more transparency and the more oversight there is on all this stuff, the better. I'm not aware of anybody in Canada that has been doing, and I mean in any of the parties, that has been doing what Wylie has described went on in the States and in England. But nonetheless, I think it has woken people to the huge amounts of data that all kinds of organizations, including political parties, are compiling on them. And I think that there's no argument except transparency in that respect.
Kathleen?
I agree completely with David that transparency is going to be more important going forward. I think even going into an electoral period here in Ontario, people will be watching and looking for how these ads are targeted at them. So I think that all political operatives need to be careful and also need to be transparent with the voters and their members.
Oh, great. So, Jamie, I'm leaving it to you. You're the non-transparent one?
No, I actually don't think the interest is just transparency. I think what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. I think it's bad any time politicians make rules that apply to everybody else but them. And I don't think that's a very good place for them to be. I think they've got to fix that up right smartly. I do think, however, Mr. Wylie's point would have been perhaps more persuasive if his hair wasn't pink.
All right. On that note, no pink hair. Kathleen Monk, David Hurley, and the effervescent Jamie Watt. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, guys.